Do we really need another computer? One that's faster, more powerful? Not everyone does. But to reinvent music using a neural processor, work off the grid with all-day battery, or bring your vision to life with AI-powered Co-Creator, then a Copilot Plus PC can make a difference. A powerful AI computer is not for everyone. But if you're trying to change the world, even if just your own, we built one for you. Microsoft Copilot Plus PCs powered by Snapdragon. Fastest, most intelligent Windows PCs ever. Battery life varies with usage and settings.
You are listening to the Glass Cannon Network, the premier source for role-playing game entertainment. Welcome to Cannon Fodder, a behind-the-scenes look at the Glass Cannon Network.
What is going on, everybody? Welcome back to Cannon Fodder. It is Wednesday, December 11th, 2024, and I'm your old pal, Joey O'Brien.
And I'm Troy, end of an era, LaValle.
End of an era, another era of the FOD, which over its long, long life has taken many different shapes and forms. This current rendition of Fodder ends today. It's very sad. We talked about it last week.
Is it?
And, well, it's not sad for you. But it's less work, less on your plate. But last week, we had the Philly show. Amazing time. So amazing to be live in Philly. Great Christmas show every year. And to, at that show, see so many people come up and be like, WTF with the FOD, man. I love the FOD. What are you doing with the FOD? It was great. I feel sad, but it was also like so nice to see such an outpouring and immediate reaction of people that are gonna miss this exact format, this exact style. But you know, fear not. As we said, the FOD has taken many different forms in its life, and it will continue to evolve. You know, talking about rules, talking about Pathfinder, talking about our games, talking about GMing. It's all going to come out in different ways. It'll be out there. Don't worry.
FOD 7.0. It was good to get some feedback from our most ardent loyal supporters. You and I were talking about it even in the dressing room after the meeting. We were like, all right, well, maybe this changes how we want to think about X, Y, and Z. So yes, fear not. There'll be something coming, but, we gotta make some changes because we've got a hell of a year, coming up next year, and we need every available moment to make sure that we deliver what you really love.
Content. Yeah. Content. There's going to be, well, like we said, there's always different evolutions of this show from when it began. And this particular evolution where we focus less on guests, more on you and I just talking about the business and Gatewalkers. This one began January 4th, 2023. So it started just last year. We did two full years, basically, of almost every week, you and I getting together. If you remember, the impetus for it was like, let's get back on FOD and talk about building up to campaign two. Talk about building the studio. Talk about putting the project together from scratch. And that was fun. That was fun. But now we do feel a little like we're in a groove where we're just talking about the same show every week, where we can't really go into depth on other shows because, like, we don't know who's caught up, who isn't, et cetera. So we're going to just move some of this stuff about Gatewalkers, our feelings on it, our feelings on the rules and the moments and everything, into Gatewalkers. We're going to spend, you know, talk a little bit more about it in show. So you'll see some more of that in there. But yeah, this current rendition of Fodder has served its purpose and is going to get sunset for now on the network. And we're going to move it into, like we said, a few different things that you'll learn about soon. Speaking of which, I mean, it's almost state of the nation time, Troy. People are getting excited. The word on the street is you're going to be dropping some big news in a couple weeks. Are you feeling good on this? Are you feeling good about this deadline, about having this happen before the holidays?
I think it's going to happen next Wednesday night. A couple weeks. Next Wednesday, the 18th.
1 week.
Yeah, I guess we'll go prime time. We'll do it at 8 p.m. Eastern. Stay tuned to where that's going to happen. Probably Twitch. That's where we tend to do our live streams. I guess there's a chance it would be YouTube, but it'll probably be Twitch, the main feed. And it's a big, big bombs I'm going to drop, talk about next year. You know, I wanted to do it at the end of last year. It didn't happen. We ended up doing it in the beginning of the winter or spring. I can't remember when the hell I did it, but now I feel like it's just a lot of question marks and a lot of big stuff happening beginning of the year. So I want to get the word out and get people mentally and emotionally prepared for pretty exciting 2025.
Pretty exciting 2025. We're very excited about it, but we can't go into any more detail here. So stay tuned next Wednesday instead of a fodder. That night live, you're going to get a state of the nation from Troy all about what is coming, our plans for 2025 for the Glass Cannon Network. The 10th year of the Glass Cannon Network. Glass Cannon Network, which is amazing. So I can't believe it. It's just, it's so wild. We got some news today, of course. We'll talk about what's coming up content-wise on Twitch. We got a lot of fun stuff this week on Twitch. We will also get into the episode some We Are Stupid. It's a great write-up from Professor Eric. And then we'll finish off with a nice little listener mail. In the classic fashion, we'll have some really good GM conversation in that listener mail. So let's kick it off. Sorry.
You hope.
I hope. Yeah. I never really plan it. You never know what Troy's going to say. Let's talk about Twitch real fast. We got a great lineup this week on Twitch. If you're listening to this on Wednesday morning, then, you still have time to catch it. Today, Wednesday, the 11th at 12 noon Eastern time, we're going to stream a little World of Warcraft. A few of us are jumping on they had a big, what they called a 20th anniversary refresh. So what they did was they opened up brand new servers that have no players on them, and they all start there at level one on the same day, everybody. And so in order to celebrate this, I was a big Warcraft guy back in the day. We decided to get Sydney into it, who had never played, get Kate into it, who I think had played but hadn't in a long time. And Mary Lou was really the one that got me to do it in the first place. So very possible we're going to have Sid, Kate, Mary Lou, and I on at noon today on Twitch. So hoping that comes together. Kate's like, work might come up. Mary Lou's like, I might have a thing happen, but we're all going to try to be there. Regardless, Sid and I will be there because we're committed to the Warcraft. So that's going to be really fun. I hope you enjoy that. Then we're going to play a slightly different, a non-MMO, much more story-focused RPG on Friday. We continue our Wildermyth adventure. These have been amazing streams. People have been turning out in droves to watch them. The ladies have been fantastic. That's going to be at 12 p.m. Eastern on Friday. That's me, Sid, Mary Lou, and Paula are playing in this ongoing campaign story in Wildermyth. That's 12 p.m. on Friday for 2 hours, followed right up after that at 2 o'clock. Troy's going to hop on. And McD for a little Gloomhaven. So I'm doing back-to-back on Friday. Oh, it feels like Extra Life. It's going to be so fun. Friday at noon, Wildermyth. Friday at 2, Gloomhaven. We beat the mission last week. So exciting. And this Friday, we're going to move on to a new scenario. So we'll see what's ahead for our heroes in Gloomhaven. You and I, this was the highlight of our literally 90 total minutes we got to spend at PAX Unplugged this weekend. We got to demo Gloomhaven Second Edition at the Cephalo Fair.
From one of the designers, and he said we're the first people to ever play it globally, which was insane. Like the printed box arrived for them the day before or 2 days before. No one had played it yet, and we just kind of stumbled in. I had an hour at the con. You got to go back on Saturday, but like I had like an hour and a half. We walked around a little bit, and we're like, you kept asking me, do I want to play a demo? I'm like, no, I don't want to do any of that. And then we saw a big sign for Frosthaven, and I was like, well, all right, if they have a demo for Frosthaven, I'll do that. We rolled up to this guy, and you're like, you demoing? He's like, yeah, come on, sit down. And you're like, is it Frosthaven? He said, no, this is Second Edition. It just came up. I don't know how we stumbled into this, and we didn't have to play with any randos, which was the best part. But once we sat down and started playing, like the list just started filling up for the whole day. I don't know what happened. Like nobody showed up to PAX right away on Friday. Last year it was like insanity.
Empty. Yeah. It was empty in there at 10:30 a.m. on Friday. Empty.
Empty.
There were so many open demo tables. I was like, come on, play a demo with me. You're like, I'm not doing that. And I'm just like, and then we go by Gloomhaven, and you're like, oh, all right, I'll consider this because it's a great game. And So, I mean, obviously lots of people have demoed Gloomhaven Second Edition. Lots of people have played around with prototypes. This designer was like, you two are the first to play the first actual finished printed copy that came off the factory floor yesterday. And so we were like, he was literally popping out the pieces for like difficult terrain and stuff like that and obstacles. It was just one of those awesome experiences you can only get going to a con. Like, you got to go to a con if you've never been to one. They're the best, and that's why. That's all I got for news. If you don't have anything else, I'm going to hop into the app today because lots to discuss.
Everything's coming out next week in the State of the Niche. All the news that's fit to print.
Okay, great. Well, let's get into the episode. Episode 62 of Campaign 2. Chunky one, long one. Lots of early roleplay stuff and characters discussing how to move forward with the options that we have. We talked about laying out options last week, about how a GM kind of, you know, you can choose to narrow down the sandbox a little bit for your players, or you can let them have a choice of everything. It can be, you know, there's good and bad on both sides. But in this case, we feel like we had three options and we settle on going to the market. But before we actually get going and start exploring, Sydney really wants to do this ritual, and we teased a little bit of the ritual last week on Fodder, talked about some of the We Are Stupid stuff that Professor Eric laid out, the DCs and whatnot. I was a little frustrated by the process, but I'm not going to talk about it now. I'm going to talk about it in a couple minutes in We Are Stupid. We'll reanalyze rituals as a whole. Professor Eric has some really interesting thoughts on that. As for Asta, she has her dream. She has entered the club that has had
dream club.
The dream club. I can't even remember if this has been discussed on Fodder, but I want you to talk about as much as you are willing to talk about the dreams. Like, how are you determining, like, when it's time for a character in this adventure to experience their dream?
Well, just when I kind of like when I feel like it. I think that's probably most campaigns would have had everybody to have their dreams by now.
Is there a guide in the book? Does it give you suggestions for how to pace it? Does it say they all get them within the first week, but you're doling them out? Like
they give a suggestion. Yeah. I knew I wanted, you know, when looking at the first episode, the premiere, I didn't see a clear ending because it starts with an investigation. And unlike Giant Slayer, you didn't have that Roderick is dead moment. You know what I mean? It's much more open-ended. So it's like, let's pace this out. I feel like I could have a dream in my back pocket that would be a great way to end episode one. But after that, I just kind of, you know, I wanted to feel out the characters a little bit more, get a sense of like who they were, what their hopes and dreams and fears were so that I could come up with something and play upon it in the moment. And so with Asta and Barnes, they have lagged behind because they're second new characters. They're new characters, you know. So after Lucky went down, I was like, oh, should have given her a dream. Didn't work out. It wouldn't really help. I think the powers are kind of like –
could have saved her life.
But after we finished book one, I was like, all right, I got to start getting the rest of these dreams out, give people their awakened powers. Because, you know, it's the third level feats. It's much more juicy when you get them early, like you and Kate did, I think. Who else is in? Skid got his.
Skid got like, his late. He got his on Castrovel.
Yeah, on Castrovel. Yeah. I just kind of paced it. And a lot of it has to do with like, all right, we've been in a slog. This is a good chance for a dream, but you also have to have that rest. You have to have that sleep. And you guys don't rest a lot. I'd love to see how many times you've rested since the beginning of the campaign, because that dictates too when I can – there could always be a daydream, right? But it's really supposed to be a dream.
It is pretty powerful. Like you said, third level feat, I believe you said, is what you're getting at first level. I got that at the end of the pilot episode. So
yeah.
Does the book have any recommendations as to when should it be doled out at first level? Is that sort of what they're suggesting?
I think they want you to – I'd have to go back and look at it, but I think they assume that you're getting it all pretty quickly.
By first level.
Yeah. But like, you know, the way we play, it really came down to the resting. Like I didn't want to do two dreams at once. I wanted them to be like good story moments for the show. And so it got to a point where like – it just didn't make sense to do it. Or you guys would rest and I didn't have anything like – I hadn't thought about it or prepared. So now it seems a little after the fact, but, you know, it's fine.
When did you know before the episode started that she was going to have her dream?
I thought about it on the drive in. I was like, I should give Asta a dream today because I could feel like arrest was imminent. I was like, all right, this is a good point.
We were in the camp, the Smiling Wolves camp.
And we went through all these fights, like, let's extend this role play and character building as long as possible. So I was like, I should maybe do a dream for – well, I was like, Austin Barnes, they're the ones that don't have this yet. So – and then I thought, like, ooh, kind of have an interesting idea for Austin. Let's see what happens. And then just kind of –
did you write anything down or did you kind of wing it in the moment?
No, I just kind of winged it in the moment. I think I wrote something down for yours and even Kate's, but I didn't for Buggles and I didn't for this one.
When you're driving in to the studio and listening, obviously, to Christmas music, are you thinking about these horrifying dream nightmares and listening to Christmas music? Or do you like have to have no music on in order for you to focus on Gatewalkers when you're driving in?
Well, I try to listen to a book on tape as much as possible, but Christmas music has changed that because I feel guilty if I'm not ingesting as much Christmas music as possible. So I'll listen to like a chapter and then go to Christmas music. When I'm listening to the book on tape, I'm a psychopath. Like if I miss a sentence, I got to go back and listen to it again. So I can't do anything else. But yeah, when I'm listening to music, I don't have to listen to mood music to write a horrifying nightmare.
Cool. Good to know. So then we head out and there is what I consider to be at this stage, in retrospect, an extremely important survival check. Brother Ramius says he's going to guide by the stars using his survival. He is the best in survival in the party. Yet I think I rolled a natural 2 or something like that. It was a bad roll.
Bad roll.
I told you the result. And you said, okay, well, like you keep getting distracted by what you see, the buildings, like they're not lining up with what they should be. And you're not paying enough attention to the stars and ignoring the tricks that are happening in front of you, the illusions, whatever they may be. And this leads us, I don't know for 100% certain that you don't get this encounter if you pass the survival check, but I suspect you do. This encounter is completely insane. Out of nowhere, a flying freaking cat comes out and just starts annihilating the entire party. Brother Ramius goes down immediately, one hit. Asta goes down, and it is extremely deadly. And now we're looking down the barrel of some sort of potential death throw. We were arguing about it after the episode. Is it going to be a death throw? Matthew says, I hope it's a death throw or something like that. I'm thinking a death throw is going to kill Asta. He's saying a death throw is better. And I'm like, well, what else could it be? And he believes it might be another form of the creature or something like that, and that it's still alive and now unhittable or something. And so I'm super stressed out about this. So without going into too much detail, obviously, we're still mid-encounter. Like, it feels a little bit insane to me. Am I crazy? I mean, Professor Eric's first line in We Are Stupid is the combat had horrible dice rolls for the players. Now, it's so long ago that I don't really remember, like, so well the dice rolls per se. I just remember feeling completely incapable of doing anything against this creature that could leap like any distance and attack as an action. Is it one action?
The pounce, yeah, pounce lets you move and attack. But I think that's a two action. No, I can't remember. That wouldn't make sense. It was, yeah, I think it's move and attack as one action.
It's just wild. And obviously, it's hitting us all the time and critting like crazy. Do you think that this is kind of a brutal encounter for a random encounter? Or do you think we just rolled bad and we're over-exaggerating?
I rolled extremely well. You guys rolled extremely poorly. That's always shitty. That seems to be the theme for the Gatewalkers campaign, which is why you already have two people dead. I try to shy away from thinking of it as a random encounter. It certainly feels like a random encounter. And I think there's plenty of that in these Paizo APs, like they're to kind of get you back to the feel of the original D&D, which was way more random encounters and you had to kind of build a story around it. I think that you guys were leaning on your frustration was kind of being like, and this is a random encounter, but it's not. I think there's something interesting here. It's like, why is this creature? No one ever asked, like, why is this creature here? Like, what, how is this tie into the weird stuff that's going on here? And there is a reason, that it's there. It's just, yeah, these single enemy encounters when I roll rocks and you guys just can't roll your way out of a paper bag. There's no amount of bottle caps that are going to save you from that. You know what I mean? And like, yeah, okay, some rerolls might get you a few more hits, but at the end of the day, I'm just rolling 17, 18, 17, 18, 17, 18, hitting on third attacks, like left and right.
You read out your number after a third attack and I have to be like, is that minus 10? And you're like, it is minus 10. It's a 27 to hit. Like, what in the hell? It's been wild. And I think that you'll see as we move on past this version of FOD, that we'll talk about it more on Gatewalkers. We'll definitely talk about it more on the episode about, we'll go into more detail on the creature and our feelings in the combat and all that kind of stuff. But right now, it just definitely feels like it's a TPK again. You know what I mean? And I hate throwing that around every fucking week on Cannon Fodder, but it really does feel like when your healer is instantly crit to dying too,
yeah,
and no one else really has the ability to heal, it's just so deadly. And the reason is partially because of the build of this creature. It can just leap to the back line to the healer and insta-crit and take them down. And I remember this during the building phase of Brother Ramius. I remember talking to Professor Eric about Brother Ramius and him saying the single most difficult thing that clerics have to deal with in the early phases before they get powerful enough is their low AC. And specifically, it's that they will get crit more. It's like, you know, everybody's going to get hit, but they will get crit more than the higher AC party members. And that is so deadly. Crits are deadly in the game. And you can see it, how it's unfolding. You know, like, yeah. I tend to protect myself, stay back, stay away. Most of the time that works. Brother Ramius very rarely is in this position. This thing, the pounce, deadly. Yeah. So deadly.
One action, move up to its speed, and do an attack at the end of the movement. And hidden, it remains hidden till the end of the attack. So, like, there's ways you can really game
so
it.
So you can crit even more because
you're hitting off guard AC.
You're hitting off guard.
Yeah. But it's got a base plus 16 to attack, which, you know, you throw a couple 17s and 18s. Now I'm hitting 33, 34. Does anybody have an AC over 24?
I don't think so. I think that's right.
Over 23.
I think 23 is right around where Zephyr is, 22, 23, maybe.
Yeah.
So, I mean, even on a third attack, you're hitting.
But just goes to show you, my rocks are what's making it so brutal. You know, because it has the damage that it's doing on the jaws is piercing and fire. So on a crit, those are both doubling. 2d6 plus 8 plus 1d6 fire becomes 4d6 plus 16 plus 2d6 fire. Like, that is so much damage. You take two crits, nobody's going to stand up after that. So, yeah, I mean, we've said this going back to Giant Slayer. It's like when but it sounds so stupid. Like, obviously, when I roll well and you guys roll poorly, things go bad. But, it's kind of been the theme of this campaign. Whereas you look at Strange Aeons, the opposite has been happening. Like, I'm rolling terribly in Strange Aeons and you guys are rolling well. And so you're having a good time. But with this, not so much.
I feel like, yeah, it's just too hard. It is. It's too hard. It doesn't make any sense. Like, even for a single character, I believe Barnes, I'm guessing here, I don't have his character sheet. I would guess that Barnes, he is maxed to melee hit. Highest you could have at this level of any class, I would think. Plus 10. Plus 16? That's six levels higher. That's crazy.
What level are you guys now? Fourth?
Four.
Yeah, so this is a creature six, so it's two levels higher. There's five
that
of
just
you.
Just feels so much higher than that. Creature six is totally fine for us to fight. Totally. Hard, but totally fine for us to fight. I just didn't know that creature six had a plus 16 to hit. That just feels wrong. I don't know. It's frustrating.
Yeah. I mean, if I roll a four, what's your AC? Is your AC 19?
18.
Yeah, so I only need to roll.
I have an extremely low AC. But
so I only miss you on a natural one. which would be a 17 to hit. A 2 is an 18. Yeah, I mean, that's brutal.
That's insane.
Brutal. So you've got to pretty much be casting shield.
Right, so anything
how
over...
How long does shield last? What about mage armor? Do they still have that?
Shield is just for a round, but that would get me up to 19.
Right. Do they have mage armor in... Probably clerics don't have that.
I don't think they do. I've never really...
called Mystic Armor.
Oh, yeah, Mystic Armor now.
And it is divine. And you can heighten it. You ward yourself getting a +1 bonus to AC and a max dex mod of +5. While wearing Mystic Armor, you use your unarmored proficiency to calculate your AC. And you can heighten it to 4th and gain a bonus to your saving throws. But it's not until you heighten it till 6 that the AC bonus increases to +2. However, even just getting a +1 for you that lasts, does this last like 4 hours like the old one? Duration until your next daily preparations. So you pretty much need to memorize Mystic Armor and cast it every morning when you wake up.
I guess. It's just frustrating. Because then it takes away a heal. Every heal is so important. And to get +1 to AC, I know it matters in this game. It really does, but
if there's no armor that you can do and there's no other,
maybe I should look into that.
Yeah, mystic
armor. Well, we're in the middle of some shit. We really don't know where it's going to go or how it's going to go down. It's real bad. It's really, really bad. And we were all kind of debating after shutting down. Not are we going to get out of this or are we going to TPK? It was like, how many are going to die? It really feels like multiple deaths, maybe not a TPK. I because we don't know what this thing is.
Felt that way with the Hobgoblins too, and you guys came out of it. So
yeah, exactly. And I think that I think TPK can definitely be avoided if this is a death throw situation. I think it's very deadly for Asta if it's a death throw situation, but then we'll survive. Mm-hmm. If it's not, this encounter keeps going on. Who knows what can happen? So it really is up in the air. Let's see what Professor Eric has to say. A little segment we call "We Are Stupid."
We are stupid.
Rituals on this edition. Let's go into some ritual talk. I think this is fun. So basically, we got the DCs wrong. We talked about that last week on Cannon Fodder. So this week we delved into it. We said confidently on air what the DC was, but we were wrong. But it's fine because the DC is not obvious by any stretch. You got to go deeper into another part of the player core and find, you know, where it says just in one line, not capitalized or anything. It just says they should have a very difficult DC. So that means bumping up the DC two levels beyond the base DC for a ritual of that level or the level of the PCs. So we know about that. Then Professor Eric says, learning a ritual uses the usual rules for learning a spell. So I didn't see where it said that anywhere, but that is apparently the deal. And that means you need to spend gold to get it. You need to, roll your die to make sure you succeed at learning it, all that kind of stuff. He says it's entirely gated by rarity, and hence it is fully GM fiat for whether a ritual is available to learn or not. That's
how
fully
I felt.
GM
fiat.
Yep. With your critique on rituals, my feeling is that they kind of bashed three different concepts together. One, they wanted to have something in the game that was a multi-participant caster situation because it's interesting.
Yeah.
And moving some of the high material cost from spells to rituals, stuff like Raise Dead or Reincarnate. These can now help allow lower level NPC churches to still provide these services. Since with NPC rules, you could still have a primary caster with a decent skill mod without needing to have higher ranked spells. So that is interesting. He says, I feel like it is actually intended more for non-PC use. Another point, and he says it here, is that one of the reasons to have rituals is the trope of a battle interrupting a ritual in progress. That's a very tropish kind of story that you tell, right? In adventures, it's like you need to stop this ritual before they complete the summoning of the great old one. Like, any sort of ritual like this could be written into a story from a homebrew perspective. You could look at the list of rituals, and there's all kinds of neat stuff in the book, and the PCs have to stop it. He says, often, though, it doesn't feel like the rules were written, and like there aren't enough written rules to explain what would happen in this style encounter. So, like, for example, what happens if a secondary caster is slain during the ritual? There's nothing in the rules that explains what happens. You kind of have to roll with that. How many actions per turn do you need to spend continuing the ritual? Can you spend one action continuing it and then two actions to do something? You know, can you sustain your part while doing something else in a fight? It's interesting when you dig into it how there are a lot of loopholes here, and it feels like they didn't quite finish it off. It's going to end up being a lot of GM fiat in rituals. So, Yeah, you know, it's just something to think about. It's like it does have a neat story element that you could put into your games, especially for enemies to be doing and for you to interrupt. But just know, there's no written rules about how it all works and how it all comes together. You're going to have to wing it and make, you know, make your own decisions, which I think is fun.
Yeah. Cool for so Sydney saying she had access to the ritual. She was right for all the wrong reasons.
Yes, exactly. Okay, real quick one. When Buggles cast invisibility, this is such a good point to always keep in mind. When Buggles cast invisibility and then ran over near the creature, Buggles probably needed a stealth check for sneaking if Buggles wanted to be undetected rather than hidden. So, like, that's just something to keep in mind, all GMs out there. Like, invisibility is not just you don't exist on this plane anymore. Like, you are there. Your presence can be heard. It can be smelt. It can be felt. And so, you know, you can give creatures a chance to know what square an invisible creature is in if the invisible creature made no effort to be stealthy while invisible. So just something to keep in mind. I think that's a point that we often overlook.
Invisibility and undetected versus hidden versus all this, it is a mini game within Pathfinder 2A. You know what I mean? I guess it was part of Pathfinder 1, but we just were like, ah, you're invisible. But like, it is a mini game that I think mimics how it would actually be if you were invisible. But for some reason, my brain refuses to fully memorize how it works every single time. Like, I learn it for the moment when I have somebody that casts like an enemy that can use invisibility. And then my brain just knows to flush that information out.
Get
so that I have
out.
To really, I don't know what it is. Like, I refuse to just fully memorize how it works. It's so silly.
Yeah, it is. It's one of those blind spots for us for sure. I think invisibility, and I think this is common for a lot of people, invisibility is just very easy to seem like a cure-all. Like, oh, and now you can't be targeted unless they have see invisibility or
right. See
the unseen, as we say in the remaster. Like,
gross.
Yeah, you hate it. But like,
so much.
What, like, that's just not the case. You have to remember, invisibility is a huge advantage, but it is not perfect.
Yeah.
It is an imperfect advantage when it comes to sensing your presence there. This is another great one. God, I love Professor Eric. By the way, Professor Eric reached out and said that, you know, still interested in being involved. And so we are definitely going to, you'll hear from Professor Eric, even though Cannon Fodder is sunsetting for now. So don't worry about that. We will get more of this in-depth info from an expert and somebody who really kind of delves into the books and pulls word for word exact lines. And thank you for doing this right here. Regarding Bless's duration after Ramius went down to dying too. Remember this? We discussed, do they all lose Bless now because I went down? Boom, he's got it right here. Player Core, page 302. If a spell's caster dies or is incapacitated during the spell's duration, the spell remains in effect until its duration ends, using the caster's initiative order. Word for word.
You were right.
Yep, that was my gut instinct, but I didn't know what page it was, so thank you very much, Professor Eric, for pointing that out. He says, this worked in this case since Bless has a duration. If the duration was sustained, it would have ended as you couldn't spend the action to sustain it. So that's really sustained is the duration you want to look for that will stop if you're ever incapacitated.
Yeah, makes sense.
And then one more thing. I'm just going to talk about this before we get into listener mail. Zephyr Damage. Professor Eric is saying that there are some people out there. I'm not sure what platform they're chatting on, but that believe that that Zephyr's damage sounds a little bit low if she had a striking rune on her hand wraps. She does not have a striking rune on her hand wraps. He says, I don't think we know exactly where all the runes went, but Zephyr was only rolling one die, so I'm assuming there's no striking on her hand wraps. I confirmed with Kate after getting Professor Eric's note, and that is correct. She put the striking rune on her longbow. So when she is punching with her fist, she is only rolling one die still, and that is why that damage feels a little bit low. He said, this is probably correct, as I think she'd prioritize her bow for upgrades. And you are right, Professor Eric. He's like, I'm more just mentioning it in case we want to double check that all the numbers got updated after the runes got put in. So, yep, thank you for double checking us. But her rune is in her longbow. She right. does have a +1 potency rune in her hand wraps, but we could not yet afford a striking rune for her hand wraps.
What is the potency bonus to hit?
+1 to hit, yeah. +1 potency rune to hit, but it doesn't increase the damage. Her longbow is +1 striking. Cool. And now she's got a short bow as well, which is great for utility when people are closer range. That has no runes on it right now. It's just a raw short bow. So, yeah, Kate confirmed all of her gear just before the FOD.
Well, there it is.
All right. Let's take it to a little listener mail. Let's hear from the Naish.
It's time for listener mail. Gotta get your brain up on it. Time for listener mail. Gotta cue that fucking
Thank you, good buddy Nick. Let's hear from Gene Willie. Or Jean Willie. I'm Jean. Sure it's Gene Willie because it's Ridgefield, New Jersey, not Paris, France.
Gene Willie.
What up, Gene? What up, Jay Willie? In Ridgefield, New Jersey, who says, in the latest episode of Legacy of the Ancients, Skid had the party make wisdom checks to remember something. I'm not going to go into detail just because people aren't caught up or whatever. Wisdom checks to remember something. What would Skid have done if everyone failed? What would either of you have done if it was your game and everyone failed? Thanks for all the great stories. I'm bringing it up here because I think it is a good general question for GMs is like, and Troy, you've been in this situation. Tell me how you handle it. What do you do when the players are all honestly forgetting something? Like that you remember, a piece of gear that they have on their person, a critical key that's on a key ring to get into a locked door, and they just forgot because it was months ago that they originally got it. Yeah. Skid sometimes does intelligence checks, wisdom checks, that kind of thing. But let's say they fail. Like, how do you shoehorn this in, or do you just tell the players, like, guys, you forgot this, that, or the other thing? I don't remember you ever doing that, like being like, guys, you're forgetting you got this. Like, how do you handle that as a GM?
It depends on the item, right? Like if it's only going to give you a bonus, but it's not like the key that you need to progress the adventure, there's a big difference, right? Like,
sure.
I feel like if it's just going to give you a cool bonus, then the onus is on the players to remember that. I don't think I'd give any check. You know, I certainly have never done it in 2E that I can remember. Give me an intelligence check. You know, I think I remember doing stuff like that in first edition in Giant Slayer, but not so much for memories, maybe once or twice. But if it's an item that like the players have to have to move on and progress the game, that's where it gets a little bit trickier. If you're giving them a check, then you have to be willing to figure out what the fail condition is. Is the fail condition they just don't remember? Then maybe the check wasn't the way to go, right? Like if it's something that they need, you can either just tell them, be like, don't forget you got this thing, or use an NPC to be like, if only we had an idol that was in the exact shape of that hole in the wall. You know, you can kind of like egg the players on with an NPC to get them there. But sometimes it's like, if it's just a black like spot in the player's memory, you can just be like, you guys actually have this thing. You got it.
Yeah. I jumping on that, I think that it's important to not do die rolls for things that are adventure stopping, like plot stopping items, like if they just honestly forgot. It makes them feel, I think, a little bit silly and a little bit stupid to have like a die roll to remember this stuff, because then they're like, oh, God, of course, blah, blah, blah. But you know, and what are you going to do if they all fail? Then you have to do it anyway, which seems kind of silly. So I would say when you're in that case, it's a key that you forgot to the door that's the only way in. Like, you just tell them that they have it. Let's say you mentioned the NPC aspect. Let's say it's neither of the scenarios we've laid out so far. It's neither a bonus that the player, a buff for the players, nor campaign breaking. What if it's something like an NPC is like, let's say they locked up a prisoner or something like that, mm-hmm. and forgot about it. Like, just forgot that this person is there. And if they just honestly forget, that person is going to die. Doesn't stop the adventure, does it? But it does, like, it has a serious impact on the story. But you know the players just honestly forgot. How would you approach that? Do you make it that the player's like, you forgot? You know, like, I always struggle with it because I'm like, there's no way the characters would forget. Like this or that thing, right? You could debate whether the characters would forget or not. It's tricky when you're debating what the characters remember versus what the players remember. But what would you do in that situation? A major story changing thing that you think is just an honest, like, they forgot it because it was too many sessions ago. It's been 3 months since we've played and now they don't remember this thing.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like if you haven't mentioned it, like, hey, don't forget about Tommy in the jail, then, like, you, the GM, are also kind of responsible for it.
So you're complicit?
Yeah. So, like, you can either give them reminders from time to time. And don't forget about that guy that you put in the prison. He's still there. I do this all the time. I'm kind of tipping my hand here, but I do it all the time in Strange Aeons. Like, the recaps that I give in Strange Aeons, I'll specifically bring up things that I know I haven't talked about in a while because they're going to become relevant in this episode. It happened in Philly. You know, I mentioned certain things in the recap, that, like, I don't want to say because I don't want to spoil Philly, but, you know, talking about the stewards and whatnot and then having, you know, you guys talk to them afterwards, it just kind of refreshed your memory about who these people are. So a recap is a great way to do it. Like, when you just want to, like, replant that seed into their head. And you can also do it with items, right? You can be like, you know, and so then that's where you got that that sword, that glowing magical sword.
Yeah, you looted that rune, blah, blah, blah. Yeah. And they could be like, oh, shit, we have a rune. That's right. We never put that in. Like, yeah, I think recaps are a great way to do it. How do you feel in general about giving players roles for their characters to remember things?
I think it's fine. It's a fine device. You just have to figure out if the fail condition is they don't remember. Like, if you're going to give them that information anyways, don't do a roll.
Right.
Or, you know, Call of Cthulhu style, punish them. Get, like, fail forward. You know what I mean? Like, all right, you remember this thing, but now you're bleeding out. You know, I don't know. You stub your toe.
But in that moment, you collapse, dying too. You have a seizure.
I think that this happens a lot, I think, to not even inexperienced GMs, just kind of inexperienced GMs, but to GMs who, like, don't quite know what to do in this moment because they're still thinking it through. It'd be like, roll a perception check. Don't have them roll a perception check if you're going to give them the answer anyways. Do you know what I mean? And it happens all the time. I'm sure I've done it. It's like, if you're going to tell them what the answer is, don't have them roll a check. Just tell them the answer.
You know, my favorite thing that you do all the time, your big foible that I think is so funny, is like always wanting to be vague, even when it's so obvious.
Dude, all the time.
Yeah. And when it was on Gatewalkers, wasn't it, just a few weeks ago? I don't even know if it hasn't aired yet, but you said, like, it seems to attack you. At least that's what it was. You were like, he seems to attack you. Then you're like, what am I saying? He attacks you.
No, in an effort to, like, build tension, I, like, over-explain.
Keeping it overly vague. That's a huge point. Do not – oh, man, this is like a great GM commandment. Do not ask for a role if you don't have a plan for the fail condition.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like,
thou shalt not ask for a role when you're going to give them the information anyways.
Yes, exactly. Like, if you don't have a plan for the fail condition, don't ask for the role. And if you, like, yeah, I think that's a good, that's just a good tenet. Just leave
or
it at that.
Or have them fail forward. Have the role happen.
But that's a plan.
That's a plan. I'm going to give you the answer no matter what. But if you fail this role, there's going to be another repercussion.
I did a lot of this on Get in the Trunk. I would set up sort of a tough choice for a character coming up in an episode. And I'd be like, if they choose this, then I'll do this. If they choose that, then I'll do that. I'll do it A or B. And then maybe they'll throw in C and then I'll just have to bob and weep. But it is what it is. Now, some of them will also be die rolls. When it comes to a die roll, this has to move forward. And I would know this. I mean, even on a failure, it has to move forward. So I would pre-plan a fail forward condition. So, you know, the classic example is, and this is like right out of, I think, the GM, the Game Mastery Guide from 1E or something like that, is like they fail on the disabled device to pick the lock. That is the only door, the only way into the next part of the story. And instead of just seeing like you can't get through, they open up the door, but now there's an extra guy in the room in the fight. Or they open up the door and a trap goes off that they didn't detect. Or they open up the door and now all the enemies are ready for them because they heard the whole thing and they get a surprise round, right? Like, there's a lot of different ways you can fail forward, but always have that in mind as a GM. Like, what's the fail forward condition?
And make sure that the check makes sense, right? Like, if you fail a wisdom check, a ton of bricks aren't going to fall on your head. You know what I mean? Like, that's right. Why in Call of Cthulhu, like, if you're trying to pick a lock and you fail the, God, I haven't played Call of Cthulhu in a while, so I can't think of what the check is. It's not stealth. Maybe it is stealth. But anyways, let's say it's stealth, right? You fail the stealth.
Picking, isn't it?
Maybe it's lock. It is lock picking. Yeah, dude, I'm so brain dead. so you, but they have the heroes have to get into this room. You've decided for whatever reason they need to get into this room. Roll the lock pick check. You fail that check. You open the lock, no problem. But there is an issue. You cut your hand as you're opening the lock. You know, now you take a little bit of damage. The characters are already so squishy. Or you make a loud noise as you unlock the lock, and that alerts the enemies that may be in the room or the guards that are walking the perimeter. Failing a wisdom check to learn information and then having you stumble into a trap, it's a little bit more of a stretch. Like, if only I was wiser, I would have seen that trap. Maybe, right? But you want to make sure that you're not punishing them for a skill that didn't make sense, that they failed.
I agree. I agree with that. But I also think that, like, that's why don't ask for the wisdom check unless you have a plan for the failure condition.
Yeah.
And that's the source of Jay Willie's question here, is like, what would you have done if you all did not remember this? This is a big deal. And the point is, like, I'd love to ask Skid that question, but I'm sure he'd be a little bit reserved, as that's it's a story moment and he might need to use that later on down the line. So I think that the main takeaway is don't ask for the check if you don't have a plan for everyone failing it, even if you think it's an easy check, especially in 1E. Wisdom checks could be like DC 12. That would be like standard. And if they all happen to just roll low, like, God, that happens. It's happened to me as a GM where you're just like, Jesus Christ, like, how am I get them moving forward? Like, if they're all failing this easy roll, you just got to have a plan for it. So, or don't give them the roll. Just let them have it. It's fine.
Right.
You know,
if, like, it's treasure they miss, let them miss it. I love it. I do it all the time.
Yeah.
I used to, when I first started GMing, I'm like, you have to find everything. So I would make sure that you would, like, roll again. Or why don't you roll, other person? But, like, if it's information that they need, just find a way to give it to them.
Right.
Don't make them roll for it if it's necessary for the progression of the adventure.
Mm-hmm. Totally. And the other one that is a bit of a, what's the word I'm looking for? A pet peeve of mine is, like, everybody give me a perception check. Everybody rolls a perception check.
Yeah.
Who knows what DC is? And you just go to whoever rolled the highest. And you say, you hear an army descending upon the city and beginning a siege. It's like, I mean, everybody can hear that. You know what I mean? Like, you don't need a perception check. Sometimes people want to just get a roll in, or they want to, like, heighten the tension by having everybody roll for something that is something that everybody's obviously going to be exposed to very quickly. I've avoided doing those. I've stopped doing that. Like, just keep the story moving and have the die roll happen when failure matters or is going to change the fork in the course of the story.
I still do it. It's a stall tactic, you know, for sure.
I've used that as a stall tactic, yeah.
But, like, because you're like, let me just – everybody roll a check while you're fucking prepping the next sentence that you're going to say. What everybody roll? You're not even listening to what their responses are because you're like, you just use that to – but you could also, like, the person who actually – in that example, right, they hear it. If there's a mechanical benefit to them hearing it versus everybody else not hearing it, like, now you get a +2 on your will save for the fucking spell that the necromancer Lancer is going to cast. Then there's merit to it. And still you can use the, like, you hear something that everyone is about to hear a second later, but that gap in time is enough to put everyone else at a disadvantage, then it's cool. I mean, that happened all the time in first edition with surprise rounds. It was much more prevalent because you could say, like, you hear fucking creakiness coming out of the room. Roll for initiative. And everyone should have heard that creakiness, but the person who did gets to act in a surprise round, whereas nobody else does. Like, there's ways around it.
Well, the tenant, yeah, that's a great point. I think the tenant there, the commandment there is, don't have people roll if there isn't a reward for succeeding at the roll, right?
Yeah. Like,
if something good doesn't come of it, or something bad on a failure that is clear and different from a failure, then don't have them roll. You know what I mean? That's kind of how I would sum that up.
Let's take it a step farther. If you're creating your own adventures, avoid creating like these items that you can't move the story without. You know what I mean? I remember playing in something years ago where, like, everyone at the table missed this item. And the GM was like, you sure you don't want to grab such and such an item to, you know, like, laid it on thick like that. And I was like, oh, I see what's happening here. That is an item that we will be unable to progress the story without. Don't do that. Like, don't create things where the only solution is forward. Missing it should have a penalty. Having it should have a bonus, but don't make it an unopenable door if you don't have that item or that information. Just try and find a little more nuance if you're doing your own homebrews.
Yeah, always have at least two ways into a thing. You know what I mean? Yeah. And always, and when it comes to those items, I think it's great having key items, pivotal plot items. That's fine.
Yeah.
But don't make them something you can only find on a successful roll. That's dangerous encounter design or scenario design. And it'll end up so many times as a GM, it'll end up having you, like, God, gnashing your teeth. Like, what have I done? Now I have to look like an idiot being like, why don't you roll a check? Double check that pile. It's just kind of silly. So just give it to them if they need it that much, you know, just be like, you find this, no roll needed. Yeah. Unless you have an idea for a failure condition. So, or you can, like, move that item to later in the adventure somewhere and have it pop up again. That's always fun too. You can always do that. But that's a failure plan. So we come back to that main commandment. Don't have them roll if you don't have a plan for success and failure.
But you just made a good point there. Like, move it. If it's an item, you can move it to a different part of the adventure. You can do that with treasure too. If you're like, man, they don't really have a lot of treasure. They've missed out on this. I'm going to do that. I don't do that often. But it's something you can do. It's just, if that item is important, just move it to a different place on the map, the world.
Puzzles. I hate puzzles. Because I feel like so often the GM just ends up telling you what the solution is. Puzzles are hard, man. And, like, easy puzzles are like, why did we do that? That wasn't that, you know, that was kind of silly. I'm so bad at puzzles. So, like, put in a hard puzzle and I just sit there until the GM just tells me what the solution is. I fucking hate them. but I love them as a GM. I love watching the players work through it. You know what I mean? I love that. I love the existence of puzzles. I just hate playing them as a player because I suck at them. All right. That's going to wrap it up, dude.
Let's go. Wow, there it is.
Hey, buddy. Last FOD for a while. Well, maybe forever. I don't know.
Slash ever?
We never know. We've said this multiple times with fodder, and it is reemerged in new and different ways. But yeah, this time we're very excited about the new things we have coming. So 1 week from today, December 18th, 8 p.m. Eastern, live on twitch.tv/theglasscannon. Tune in for the State of the Nation and find out what's coming in 2025. Maybe you'll start to put together this matrix of how we're going to reimagine fodder in many different ways. So tune in for that, and you can put the puzzle together yourself. Thanks, good buddy. It's been a fun 2 years doing these week in and week out, and I look forward to doing it again in different ways in the future.
Yeah. Merry Christmas, everybody.
Yeah! Merry Christmas. We'll see you soon. Bye!
Bye!
Do you like what you hear? Well, then it's time to make your membership official. You can start your 30-day free trial today and become an official member of The Nation at jointhenation.com with the promo code GCN30. That's jointhenation.com and use code GCN30. That's GCN30 to gain access to exclusive podcasts, ad-free episodes, and live streams you can't find anywhere else. Once again, it's jointhenation.com. Use code GCN30 at sign up to get your first 30 days for free. See what everybody else is talking about and join The Nation today.